going to call the meeting to order. We are even a couple minutes late here for the Health and Human Services Finance Division. Good afternoon, everybody. So the clerk is noting the roll, and I don't know if we have a quorum yet. Probably not. So we'll do the minutes when we get a quorum. But first, I just want to start by letting members know that you have been given today a book, which is the 2020 to 2021 biennial budget. So this book is, as you can see, there's a lot here. It's heavy. There are many pages. And this is a book that is, Ms. Niedernhofer has spent an enormous amount of time compiling and getting for each of you, and your name is on your book. If you note, it says, please do not remove this book from the committee room. It is your book. You may remove it from the committee room, but please keep track of it, because there will be days when you will want to refer to it. And although I think we may have some extras, this is a big deal to give everybody another one if you should lose it. And, of course, this is your evening reading for when you're having insomnia. I'm just kidding. No, I probably very few people read this thing cover to cover. I know Mr. Berg does, though. He's probably got it memorized. But I just want to point out to you, if you open up the front cover, you have a list of accounts. And as I understand it, the book is in the order of those accounts, right? Am I right? And when you see all these tabs in your book, just realize that our staff had to put all those tabs in your book. So this was a lot of work, but to make the book more useful. And so this is the existing budget for all of the accounts that are under this committee's jurisdiction. If you want to know what somebody's doing right now, this is where you're going to go to look for it. And so we're going to probably be referring to this as we go along. As we get the governor's budget proposal, this is the base on which those changes are going to be built, because this is the current budget. So there's a tremendous amount of information in here. Mr. Berg is staff for our committee. He's our nonpartisan fiscal staff. He's available to any member to answer questions about the budget, to even help you understand how to read the budget. He's been really helpful to me. I've got a ton to learn here as well. This is the lesson from this, and if anybody in the public is watching, this is really complicated. And the members of this committee are going to really wrestle with trying to understand the budget and, you know, how when you make changes to the budget, how it impacts everything. So just to know that he's available as a resource in addition to our other nonpartisan staff that deal more with the policy side, but he's the fiscal guy, and if you need an explanation of how something works or you need information that's not here, he's your guy to go to. We do have a quorum present. Is there a motion to approve the minutes? Representative Moran moves to approve the minutes of January 24th. Is there any discussion of the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. And the minutes are approved. Thank you very much. So we are very fortunate today to have Stefan Gildemeister from the Department of Health. He is our state health economist. And I actually didn't realize that was his title, but it's one that he well deserves. I know a lot of members have worked with him. And Mr. Gildemeister, if you would come on down to the table. And he's going to give us a presentation on the state of health care, the state's state of health care. And so this should be very interesting. I'm looking forward to it. And Mr. Gildemeister, please just introduce yourself for the record and proceed. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Stefan Gildemeister. I direct the Health Economics Program in the Minnesota Department of Health, and I'm the state health economist. And everything that I'll show you today is work that we've carried together over several months and years tracking the healthcare market. And I want to recognize some of my colleagues who are here, Alicia Simon, and she brought her son who's off school so that he finally figures out what his mama is doing. Norman and Alicia over there. Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, Madam Chair, you introduced the session as my speaking about the state of healthcare. I think I'm going to be a little bit more modest and maybe focus on coverage and costs. But if you'd like me to go deeper or in different directions, please stop me, and I'm happy to do so.
That's okay, Mr. Gildemeister. I'm just reading my script, so
excellent.
Whatever you do, that's what we're going to do.
Thanks, Madam Chair. So it's nevertheless a challenge to sort of talk about what we know about coverage and cost, and the way I'll try to meet that challenge is by really serving up as many graphs and slides with data as I can in the shortest amount of time. But please stop me if there are too many lines or too many pie graphs or too much information.
And Mr. Gildemeister, this might be a good time for me to say that to members that, as before, I think the best opportunity we have to get through the presentation is if we kind of hold our questions, unless the questions are, I can't read the slide, or what's that acronym, something that's keeping you from following. Otherwise, please make note of your questions, and let's kind of hold off on them. And Mr. Gildemeister, if you can kind of, if you reach sort of sections in your presentation and you want to pause and take questions, just let us know, and we'll do it like that so we don't interrupt you all the time and pull you off course. So please go ahead.
Thanks, Madam Chair. So starting with coverage, about 5.6 million Minnesotans in 2017, who has coverage? Through what sponsor do people have insurance coverage in the state? So on the left-hand side, you see that pie chart that illustrates that about 60% of Minnesotans have private health insurance of some form or another, either through an employer or by buying it directly through the individual market. And then on the left-hand side, public program coverage adds to about 35%, composed of people who have Medicare coverage, coverage for the elderly, and state public program coverage like medical assistance, Minnesota's Medicaid program, and Minnesota Care. And about 6%, 6.3%, or 350,000 Minnesotans did not have health insurance coverage in 2017. So on the right-hand side, we're looking at what portion of people with private coverage are in a fully insured setting versus a self-insured setting. And the distinction here is that many large employers choose to buy insurance coverage in a way where they retain the insurance risk. So in other words, they rent the network, whereas most of us buy insurance coverage, we buy a policy, and we pass on the insurance risk to the health insurance company. So starting at a high level, I'll dig in a little lower, and I'll look at trends over time.
And Mr. Gildemeister, could you just explain a bit more the difference between self-insured and fully insured? Those are really confusing terms.
Yeah. So again, self-insured typically means the employer who buys, and then typically a large employer like a Best Buy, but also the state of Minnesota, buys insurance coverage by renting a health plan network, but being ultimately responsible for the healthcare costs that are accumulated. Most of us buy an insurance policy with a premium and a benefit set and cost sharing, and the insurance company has the incentive then to manage that risk, whereas in a self-insured setting, the employer retains that risk and seeks to manage it.
Thank you.
So looking at some of these trends over time, what we have seen now for 15 years or so is a downward trend in private coverage and an upward trend in public program coverage that doesn't quite compensate for the loss of private coverage. So on the top, you see the trend in group coverage. This is employer coverage through an employer. And at the bottom, you see sort of the smaller component of what we call non-group coverage or coverage in the individual market. So as I said, what we've seen over time is that individuals, even if they've been offered employer coverage, choose to opt out. We call that they take up coverage at lower rates. But I think what was interesting in 2017 was that the take-up rate has stayed the same, but still a smaller portion of individuals are linked up with an employer who offers coverage. So that doesn't necessarily mean that fewer employers make insurance coverage available, but rather that the nature of the labor market seems to be shifting away from a model where you're connected to an employer that pays you wage benefits and non-wage benefits, but rather more and more of us sort of work as independent contractors where we're responsible for obtaining insurance coverage. The individual market, as I said, has always been a small component or a smaller space through which individuals obtain insurance coverage. It's peaked up a little in 2014 and 15 with the implementation of the Affordable Care Act and the policies wrapped around creating a stable insurance market there. But we've seen a decline in the individual market over time that I know you're aware of. This is sort of illustrating that decline by looking at member months. So what you can really see at a high of 2014 and 2015, the market has about shrunk to a bit more than half of its size. Here we're looking at member months, but enrollment in the individual market has been around 150,000 individuals. And I'll let my friend Peter Brickwitty correct me if I'm wrong, but we think that has leveled off, and that's sort of the level of enrollment that we've seen into 2018 as well. Next, I'd like us to take a look at the trend in uninsurance, and here's sort of what we have observed. Minnesota has historically been a state with the lowest rate of uninsurance or the highest rate of coverage. So, you know, together with Massachusetts, Vermont, Hawaii, we are one of the three, four states who historically have had low rates of uninsurance. Mostly that has been a result of high levels of employer coverage, where Minnesota employers are either large and sort of out of competitive demands offer health insurance coverage, or where it's sort of part of the fabric of society. But to an extent, it's also an outcome of having programs like Minnesota Care for individuals, subsidized programs for individuals with low and middle incomes. But what we've seen over time is that as a result, sort of as a delayed result of recessions, the uninsurance rate has crept up, and typically that has not been corrected over time as the economy recovered or grew. So, and that's pretty stable until 2014, again, when the Affordable Care Act was implemented, and that brought about 150,000 individuals to coverage, and most of that into public program coverage, dropping the uninsurance rate to about 4.3%. What's been a little surprising, though I think we're sort of piecing together some thoughts on that without having real data on causality, is that in an environment of economic growth and really low unemployment, the uninsurance rate in 2017 has started to climb up again. So that's worrisome for two reasons. I think it's worrisome because you know, we have public insurance programs to deal with some form of uninsurance that relates to sort of the economy or circumstances where individuals lose income. In an upward economy where people don't become income eligible for these programs but still choose not to afford coverage, we don't really have good mechanisms to correct for that. And so that is something to think about and something to be worried about. As I said, this is a little bit of a speculation, but Some of it is based on data. When we ask individuals, why did you choose not to continue coverage, oftentimes cost comes up as a factor. But also sort of more through inferential statistics, what we're observing is that the environment in 2016, 2017 was really volatile, the policy environment, and there was a lot of confusing messages around, you know, do I still have the requirement? Will there still be the subsidy? What will happen to healthcare costs? So that created such uncertainty that I think a number of individuals stepped away from insurance coverage.
Okay. Mr. Gildemeister, excuse me a moment. Representative Loeffler?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Gildemeister, I'm just wondering, and maybe you don't have the background materials to say this, but seeing the decline in group membership, group coverage, I have heard anecdotally from constituents about employers dropping family coverage but in keeping employee coverage. And I'm wondering if that's a trend that you have seen or you think plays into that group coverage decline. And the other thing that I have heard is just with the penetration of the high deductibles and them getting much higher, that people who can't survive a layoff like the federal employees have had right now just don't see the value in signing up for something with a $15,000 or $20,000 deductible, and they just take their chances. And I'm just wondering if you have any data on whether those are just anecdotes or if we're starting to see that as a trend.
Yeah. Mr. Gildemeister?
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, I think there are a couple of thoughts I would bring to responding to your question. Definitely employers are focusing their benefits on their employee. To some extent, that may result in not offering family coverage, or more likely to limit the subsidy they offer to that employee or to those dependents. So, you know, when an annual family premium is about $18,000, stepping away from contributing to it at historical levels makes this really a painful expense for individuals at different levels of incomes. So we've certainly seen the pain point on family coverage. I think the question as to value is definitely a fair one. I don't know that we have data where we understand how people respond to high deductible health plans, but certainly sort of the combination, the triangle of high premiums, high cost sharing, and limited networks in some circumstances will have people ask whether insurance coverage in that form is consistent with their other spending priorities. And I think that's what we're seeing a lot, that folks are asking themselves, is this the way I want to allocate spending? But this is a little bit of conjecture. We don't know that there's consistent information on that level for Minnesota. So what we know comes from national data and from piecing together a few studies here and there.
Yeah. And Mr. Gildemeister, members, I am just, most of you were probably not in the room when I said this, but this stuff's really interesting, and I know we're all going to have a lot of questions and want to discuss it, but we're going to try to let Mr. Gildemeister get through his presentation, and so we're going to, if you have clarifying questions, please ask them, but otherwise we're going to try to get through a section and then have these more intensive questions. So please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A few more words on the uninsurance, on the uninsured. So most of the uninsured are long-term uninsured. That means more than half. That means they have been uninsured for a year or longer. So those are not folks who are in a transition, but who sort of have for a longer time not have had insurance coverage. Also, it's important to remember that Minnesota uninsured and uninsured across the country are not homogeneous. So you might have low-income individuals who are unable to seek coverage or afford coverage or to avail themselves of public program coverage. But you also might have self-employed individuals with a steady or unsteady income who sort of make these trade-offs between having coverage and retaining the income for other expenditures. That said, there are pretty dramatic variations in the rate of coverage across demographic characteristics, age, income, race, ethnicity, and education. And as at the end of my slide deck, I don't plan on presenting it, but I showed you some of those rates for your consideration. Most of the uninsured in Minnesota are adults, but in 2017, about 50,000 of them were children under the age of 18. And then most of the uninsured actually have some path towards subsidized coverage. What do we mean by that? About 18% are connected to an employer who offers coverage and are eligible for that coverage. So that may mean they're working for that employer, or rather a spouse works for an employer who offers coverage and offers family coverage. About half of the uninsured, 51% in 2017, I'm sorry, this slide marks the green line as 15, it should be 17, about half are eligible for one of the public programs, and about 22% appear income eligible for APTC, so they could get a subsidy on a policy purchased through the individual market if they pursue it through Minsure. So the corollary to this is to ask what share of the uninsured don't really have any pathway to insurance to a subsidized insurance coverage, and that's about 12.5%. And the number is that low because individuals might have multiple eligibilities for healthcare subsidy. And maybe I'll pause here because this was my last sort of look at insurance coverage, and next I'll go into looking at how the 96.7% of the population and the 6.3% of the uninsured, how they spend resources on healthcare.
Okay, and so members, I think if this is a pause point here, we can ask a few questions. Let's see, we got a list. Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Looking at slide five and the individual market, just for clarity, what's the income level for that group of individuals and what profession, if there is a profession that this group is in?
Mr. Gildemeister.
Madam Chair, Representative Moran, you know, the individuals in the individual market or in the non-group market really are across the spectrum of income. I mean, they are less likely to be low income. They are less likely to be older than 65 where they could obtain Medicare coverage. But otherwise, they're across the spectrum. Same profession-wise, I mean, they are less likely to be working for an employer, for a large firm who offers coverage, but they might be an architect, they might be a farmer, they might be somebody who sort of works in retail for an employer who doesn't offer insurance coverage. Self-employed are more likely to be in the individual market. So sort of more by definition, if you don't have a means of accessing subsidized coverage, where you go is the individual market.
Madam Representative, Madam Chair, is there an income level?
Again, I think,
that they don't qualify for any public subsidy, so they have to be somewhere in a range.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, there's a range, and I should maybe provide that to you. I think they're less likely to be lower income for the reasons that you described, but they're very much across the income spectrum at the upper end, which is where I think some of the pain points around the cost of insurance coverage comes to bear. But yes, maybe if you allow us, we can send you that information, that income distribution, in a day or so.
Thank you. Okay, thanks. I've got Schultz, Bierman, and then Munson. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm just struck by slide number five. When we have really low unemployment like we do now, that this group coverage would decline. And I'm just wondering, have you done any deeper dive into whether there's some crowd out going on, that people are not being offered, or they're moving from full-time to part-time, so they may not be eligible for group? Or do you see any other dynamics going on in that, in the employer-sponsored insurance market?
Mr. Gildemeister.
Madam Chair, Representative Schultz, it's a little bit of a head-scratcher, and I would say the two... So we've done a lot of analysis, but I don't know that we have identified sort of a definitive cause. Healthcare costs, sort of to the point that Representative Loeffler raised, healthcare costs and the perception of value, it is a factor. But sort of the decline in the percent of the population who are associated with an employer who offers coverage is sort of another factor. Sort of, I don't want to. We don't really have strong data on that. Certainly not in Minnesota. But there seems to be sort of a shift to the gig economy, and what that means when people are in the gig economy is that they don't work for an employer who offers insurance coverage. Presumably, the income that they derive from their engagements would be one route to purchase insurance coverage, but we don't know to what extent that happens in upstart businesses or in all kinds of arrangements. I think family coverage is an area where we have seen both changes in the comprehensiveness of the offer, but also where take-up is affected by sort of changes in the design of family coverage.
Thank you. I just have one follow-up.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then on slide 7, I'm still struck that 50,000 children remain without health insurance in Minnesota. And I've seen estimates before that about half of our uninsured are really eligible for some sort of assistance with their premiums or some public program. So do you have any suggestions on how we can cover 100% of children in the state?
Thank you, Representative Schultz. That's a pretty big question, yeah. But Mr. Gildemeister, you want to take that on? What should we do?
I don't know that I can suggest, Madam Chair, Representative Schultz, I don't know that I can suggest what you should do, but sort of one mechanism would be to presume eligibility for coverage for any child that presents itself for health care. You know, children are healthy, their health care needs are low. You know, that would be one mechanism.
Good answer so far.
I think the other point I would make, Representative Schultz, is, and we don't have a full understanding why people who are eligible for insurance coverage choose not to take it up. It's, you know, it's as diverse, I think, as the uninsured themselves. But there may be people for whom holding insurance coverage does not even match their other challenges in their personal lives. So when individuals are wondering about how to keep the lights on, they might not really think about coverage. They might also have a really good experience with the safety net where they feel they get their basic needs met. But as I said, we don't have a complete understanding. It's sort of a mix of health insurance literacy, sort of the challenge in understanding the system and how to get enrolled with it, worry about cost, but also sort of a misunderstanding about what the actual cost might be.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. So we have Bierman, Munson, and then Grunhagen, and then maybe we could kind of move on to the next section. Representative Bierman.
Seems like we could talk about, well, we were just talking about the rest of the hour, no problem. From the campaign trail, my 2 cents on that whole thing about insurance and jobs are that I met a lot of people who were struggling to find a job where they could get health insurance, but they were instead having to work 2 or 3 jobs where it wasn't offered. I had plenty of people who told me they were 5 hours away from getting health insurance. And so I think there is, throughout the economy, small business, large employers, there's an effort to avoid having to pay health insurance. And I think this system is also very complex, and what you just referred to about people who the complexity of their lives is such that adding to trying to figure out health care is just one more thing they can't deal with at their when they're at their breaking point. That's my statement. My question is, administrative costs for publicly financed healthcare in Minnesota. I hear from people who are allegedly in the know, I hear 2% to 18%. Can you shed any light on where we are at with the administrative cost of healthcare in the state? And then also, in this state, people who don't have health insurance but need medical care can go to the ER and get treatment. And I'm just wondering what the percentage of uninsured that seek that remedy, what we are faced with in that realm, please.
Okay, good questions. I don't know if Mr. Gildemeister has all the answers, but hope you do. Please.
Madam Chair, Representative Bierman, good questions and tough questions. To start with your second question around the uninsured and how they seek health care, we can look up that information. So we asked that as part of a survey, and we have some data on it. And the expectation, I think, that you have is met in reality, that the uninsured are much more likely to seek care through the safety net and the emergency room than through a usual source of care, which is a physician or a doctor's office, where they typically go to seek health care. So that makes sense. On administrative spending, I don't have the answer at my fingertips, but I think in part because we would have to sort of discuss which administrative spending. Is this the cost of administering health insurance coverage? We have that data for the private market, and we are about to release an annual report on that. I'll make a point of sharing it with you. Or is that the cost of administering healthcare throughout the system, at the provider level for billing purposes, et cetera, across the insurance market? I assume you're interested in the former. I don't have data for the cost of public. The cost of administration in a public setting, I would the Department of Human Services might be better at that. My hunch would be it's certainly closer to 2% than to 18, but it may not be 2%.
Okay. Representative Bierman, anything else? Okay.
No, that's it. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is really a fascinating presentation, Mr. Gildemeister, and I'm anxious to get into the data. I wanted to address one thing that Representative Moran had brought up. I'm a prime example of being in this 5% of people. I've been self-employed for 10 years, and I do consulting work. I think you brought up people that were independent contractors, and I think that's a growing trend in Minnesota, especially as employers recognize the enormous costs that go with hiring someone, not just in their salary, but in all the benefits that go along with it. And so allowing people to shop for their own care and benefits is an advantage that people have, especially when you can onboard and release employees. In my district, what I found was that there's a lot of small businesses who used to offer care to their employees that they have less than 50 employees. And with the skyrocketing cost of care and with the surges of MnSure, they just gave their employees a monthly amount of money and said, you're on your own for health care. And so that was a way for the employers not to be burdened with this cost and to give their employees some price transparency in health care so they can actually see what the actual costs are and go out and shop for competitive health insurance. And that may be one of the reasons why we saw the group health drop off, and I'd be curious to get your input. The other item I wanted to mention, too, is that even though there's people in my district that are not showing up as the uninsured, there are hundreds and hundreds of families in my district who had insurance through they were required to buy it. They had a multi-$1,000 deductible, and then they don't go to the doctor because they're afraid of what it costs. And so they have insurance. They're not showing up on here because they have insurance, but they're afraid to go to the doctor, so they don't use their insurance. And I would encourage members on this in this committee, as we start talking about the health insurance problems, that you recognize that it's not necessarily the cost of insurance that we should be discussing. It's the underlying cost of health care that's driving the insurance rates up. And so requiring people to have insurance or trying to figure out how to subsidize the premiums may not be the solution, but just going after the underlying cost is actually probably the best benefit to increasing access to care.
I think there was a question there
on the small employers to see if that was it, the numbers in here for the employers. that used to offer care? Do you have a list of, like, the numbers of employers that offered care and then went down? Or is it just reflected in the numbers of people in group?
Mr. Gildemeister.
Madam Chair, Representative Moore, Representative Munson. Yes, so I think your perception is right. Small employers are, particular with the emergence of the APTC, small employers sort of have that option to delegate the responsibility to obtain health care to individuals, and I think some definitely take advantage of it. It's difficult to see that in data quite yet because the underlying group of individuals in the small employer market are small. So statistically, it might not bubble to the top, but we see that definitely that tendency to appear. I'll make a point in looking that up and also sharing that with the committee chair.
Okay, and just one more follow-on to what Representative Moran brought up about people, I think it was her that brought up about people being qualified for programs. A lot of self-employed people who enter their tax information through the MnSure program will qualify for these programs. In going through personally and doing this in 2015, I think, my children were put on medical assistance. I didn't know this. I thought they had Blue Cross, but it wasn't until we went to the doctor and found out that the doctor wouldn't take their insurance that I realized that it was medical assistance that they were put on. And just because of the deductions that we had on our taxes and where our income was at the end, in the AGI, my children were put on medical assistance. Took months to try to get them off of that program because the doctors wouldn't take it. Mm-hmm. And so, and then we were out of enrollment for putting them in private insurance. But that, I think there would be a lot of people who qualify for it. And then also the 200 hours that we spent dealing with MnSure over the 2 or 3 years we were through that program, it just wasn't worth it to us. And so we went back to, you know, private insurance, buying it from an agent and not going through, even though we may qualify for advanced premium tax credits. It's just, it was a hassle, and it's a program that needs to work the kinks out.
Okay. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Gildemeister?
Gildemeister.
It's nice to talk to somebody who's got a longer name than Grunhagen, to tell you the truth. Yeah, I'm on slide 5, too, and since I've sold individual and small group health insurance since 1978, so I'll just give a couple observations, and then I have a question. Representative Munson and Representative Bierman both stated some information I would agree with. Number one, when Obamacare was passed, I lost several small groups. The employer just canceled them out and said, we're giving you a stipend because we can't continue to maintain these double-digit increases. We'll just give you a flat rate. That way we can control, go out in the market by your own. Some people did, some didn't. Also, it's important to keep in mind that Obamacare invalidated a lot of group insurance that didn't meet their requirements. I had several of my customers lose their group insurance from an employer where they used to have it because the group plan didn't meet the requirements of the ACA. The other thing that happened, employers moved some of my customers to 29 hours a week. Therefore, they didn't have to meet the requirement of 30 hours have to offer health insurance. The result is those people had to find a second part-time job to try to make ends meet. So there's all kinds of good results from Obamacare. The third thing is my sister works for a dentist. I also have customers who work in the billing department of my local hospital. Under Obamacare, according to the information I received, we went from 18,000 CPT codes to over 140,000 CPT codes. The complication of billing Medicaid and Medicare under and even under the ACA is ridiculous. So when we look at the administrative cost, I think we have to look at the burden the providers are under. One of my customers that worked in the billing department, she's retired now, she said, the one job I used to do years ago, they now have to hire 12 people at the hospital to do the same job, okay? So I think something's wrong there, okay? So it's not just the administration of government, it's the implications of what we do to those providers, okay? Now, I appreciated your comment. If I heard you correctly, your statistics are going to look at the ramifications on providers as far as administrative costs are concerned under the current rules and regulations?
Mr. Gildemeister?
Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen, to the length of the name. My wife's name is actually even longer than mine, and she's Norwegian. But to your question, we don't really have good data, any data really that I'm aware of, on the administrative cost for providers. I mean, it's considerable, and it is considerable in part because providers need to know different prices for different health plans. I think the complexity that you mentioned with the coding systems moving from ICD-9 to ICD-10 and so forth, is another contributing factor. I think it is sort of a reflection of I don't know if these are unintended consequences or the more precision we seek, the more work it is to get that. There's a balance there, and I think the outcome doesn't always suit all of us, I think.
Yeah.
Just one quick follow-up.
One quick follow-up.
Comment. Thanks for that. I think it's something that should be looked at. Both my sister and other customers and friends who've worked in these billing departments say that they are ready to pull their hair out. Some of them have. So you're contributing to baldness in the state? No. But it is so complicated. The provider sometimes just gives up and says, forget it. We just did the service. We're not even going to try to collect anymore. I mean, that's where we come to, okay? So to the degree you can simplify that, I would sincerely appreciate it. And you'd eliminate quite a bit of misery in the state.
Well, okay? Representative Grunhagen, Mr. Gildemeister can do a lot of things, but I don't think he's in control of that. He's kind of doing research, and that's kind of our job, actually, and the job of Congress as well. Certainly a lot of this, of course, comes from Congress. But I just want to say one thing, to emphasize something that Mr. Gildemeister said, is that from the provider point of view, they're dealing with multiple insurers, and every insurance has its own requirements. And so that very much adds to the complication of what the providers have to deal with and to their administrative burden, even though we don't have a really good quantification of that, and I'd love it if we did, but we really don't. So anyway, let's move on, if we could, Mr. Gildemeister, and go on to the next section.
Madam Chair, just to check in on time, are we good?
We are going until 2 o'clock with your presentation, and then we're going to hear very briefly from Mr. Brickwitty.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So talking about then what all that health insurance translates to in healthcare spending, and I'm drawing here from a report that hasn't been published yet. So it's an annual report to the legislature on healthcare spending. So it's privileged information. It's final, but it's not been released. We hope to release it in the next month or so. But looking at this chart, the bars represent annual healthcare spending in billion dollars, and the green line represents year-over-year growth in that number. I would say that there are two things to observe. One is here is your universal constant in healthcare spending. Healthcare spending goes up every year, typically faster than inflation. And independent of what else is happening in the economy or in the health policy space. You might be able to change that. You might wish to change it. But so far, healthcare spending has gone up year over year. The trend in the rates of growth, though, has been varied. In the late 90s through early 2000s, it's been close to double digits. With the recession, it's been declining to moderate levels of growth. And since 2011 through the current year for which we have data, 2016, it's been fairly moderate by historical standards, with perhaps the exception of 2014, when, as I said, 150,000 individuals came into the market and were able to, some for the first time, most actually for the first time, to hold insurance coverage and seek health care.
And Mr. Gildemeister, are those, that's obviously not a per capita. This doesn't reflect the growth in the population or the aging of the population. Am I right there?
That's correct. This is total healthcare spending on services and supplies for all Minnesotans. So population growth is about 1% a year. About 30,000 Minnesotans the last couple of years have been added to Medicare, so they typically have a higher rate of chronic disease, et cetera. So that plays into it. We can look at this at a per person level and also sort of look for ways to risk it, to make the trends comparable, if that's of interest to the committee.
Yeah, age adjusting, I think, mm-hmm. would be helpful given the age wave that we're all experiencing. Please continue.
So who paid for the title is grammatically awkward or incorrect, but essentially the question here was intended to be who pays for this healthcare spending, and I take a step back and say, really, everyone, all of us, individuals, pay for healthcare spending through foregone wages, through taxes, through spending on premium and an out-of-pocket cost. But what we're doing in this analysis is we're asking which sponsor pays, routes these fundings to the healthcare system. And most of it is private coverage, sort of composed of private health insurance on the left-hand side, out-of-pocket spending right above it, and other private spending which relates to auto medical and workers' comp, private workers' comp insurance. And then on the other side, about 40%, again, equally distributed across Medicare and Medicaid, comes through those programs. So about half public, about 40% private, and then or half other public, which also includes Veterans Administration spending, TRICARE, etc. So some of you might be remembering the slide on the distribution of individuals with insurance coverage, and what I want to show you here is that you're remembering correctly. There were about 35% of individuals who had public health insurance, yet spending accounts for about 47% of total spending. And that's, of course, in part by the design, to the extent that Medicare covers elderly people, where about 80% have one or more chronic diseases, and Medicaid covers a lot of young individuals and a good portion of healthy individuals, but also people with disabilities. So that imbalance is, if not by design, sort of an outcome of the design. Public spending, most of it originates with the federal government through a number of mechanisms, but the state pays about 90% of the total healthcare spending. So where does the spending go? About a third of the $47 billion in 2016 went to hospital-based care. So that's both inpatient healthcare services, but also healthcare services delivered in settings that are affiliated with hospitals, outpatient clinics, outpatient departments, et cetera. About 20% goes to pay for physician services, about 15% to long-term care. Prescription drug accounts for what might seem like a small number, 11%. In part, that is because here we're looking, and oftentimes we're looking just at retail spending, sort of the prescription drugs that are filled in a pharmacy. There's a whole other world of prescription drugs out there, and those are drugs delivered in hospital settings and administered in office-based settings, for instance, through an IV for cancer patients. Those oftentimes are the specialty drugs that have incredible prices in the first place and also experience tremendous growth year over year. So if we add those in, prescription drugs are closer to 20% than the number shown here. So we often like to compare ourselves to the nation, particularly if it's a favorable comparison. I can help. Healthcare spending in Minnesota per capita is below that at the national level and has been historically. In 2016, it was about $8,500 in Minnesota and about $9,800 dollars at the national level. Taking that and adding to it the stronger economy that we have in Minnesota compared to the national average, that also translates to us devoting a smaller share of the economy to health care, about 14% in Minnesota and about 17% nationally. So typically, you know, when we think about spending and growth and sort of ask questions about why is it so difficult to constrain spending or to affect healthcare spending, we ask what are the drivers, and there are different ways in cutting and slicing healthcare growth. This is one intuitive way that we've pursued a couple of times, where we ask, what component of the change in prices, for instance, down here, the 7.7% growth between 2012 and 2014, is driven by price increases versus by volume or increases in utilization or changes in service mix? And service mix is, you know, getting a better MRI, a more costly MRI, having inpatient surgery instead of outpatient surgery, those kind of things. And you know, with one exception, across the board, prices are the primary drivers of healthcare spending growth. So about three-quarters of the growth for this period across the country and other periods seem to be driven by changes in prices for the same kind of services. Volume plays a very small role. In fact, for the hospital sector, we've seen declines in hospital-based services, inpatient care.
Meister, excuse me. Representative Baker, did you have just a clarifying question?
I'm going to wait till the end. Just put me on the list.
Okay, very good. Sorry. Please continue.
And service mix, Madam Chair, and service mix also plays a smaller role. So, you know, there are lots of papers out there who look at this from different perspectives. One is titled, "It's the Price is Stupid." In that comparison, we're looking at the difference between spending in the U.S. and spending in other countries. But even when we just look at the healthcare market sort of within the state, prices play a really substantial role in healthcare cost growth. And we don't think it's going to change. What I mean by that is, as part of our work, we project future healthcare spending, and by our analysis, looking at economic trends, looking at coverage trends, looking at the underlying trends in prices, we expect healthcare spending to double in 10 years, reaching $94 billion in 2026. So at that point, doubling healthcare spending, raising the rate of the share of the economy devoted to healthcare. At that point, I think we'll all be facing the question about whether we have to refocus our priorities in spending. What I'm trying to say is not that there's a right or a wrong level of spending for society, but rather to say what we spend on healthcare or in any other policy space is a reflection of our priorities. So as we spend more on healthcare, there's less to spend on other in other areas, and that's just a matter of balancing two sides of an equation. But these questions don't just emerge at an overall societal level, but they also have impact sort of at an individual level, and this is sort of one way of looking at it. In this slide, I'll pick that apart a little bit for you. In this slide, we're looking at the cost of coverage across a couple of market spaces. Employer coverage on the left, individual market coverage in the middle, without APTC, with APTC, and then sort of the hypothetical, what if the high risk pool was still in existence in Minnesota. And there are two things I think to take away. Affordable coverage, whatever the mechanism is, seems to require substantial subsidies. You know, around 75% on the employer side, a little less in the individual market here. In the examples we chose for 57-year-old in Morris, in Wilmer, Minnesota, and much, much higher for a population like a high-risk pool population, that has much more dramatic healthcare needs. So that is one point. The second point is for those who don't have that subsidy available to them, the lift on healthcare costs can be pretty substantial, and that's what you're seeing here on the second bar. Secondly, this came up in one question earlier, when I think it was Representative Munson, when we think about healthcare costs and the burden of healthcare, we tend to think about it on the premium side. How much does it cost to buy coverage? Economists think that way as well. Decisions are typically made on the premium level, do I buy, do I not? And it's much more complex to consider the full picture for patients and for people who are considering buying coverage. Yet the intent to keep premiums affordable means healthcare spending, if we are unable to affect the underlying cost of healthcare and the rising cost of healthcare, then a cost of the share has to move somewhere else, right? And in this case, it moves to consumers. It's sort of delegated to consumers through great out-of-pocket costs, whether that is, or more narrow benefits, whether that is point-of-service costs, like cost sharing, or co-insurance, or whether those are deductibles. And what we've seen here, looking just at the commercial market for Minnesota over the last 10 or so years, the 15, 14 years, is that enrollee cost sharing per person has risen by more than twice the rate as the share of spending of health plans. So clearly, there's a shift in responsibility to individuals, and we feel that. And we feel this not just at the time when we sign up for coverage, we also feel it when we make healthcare decisions, and that was also a point Representative Munson made. When we ask individuals, has there been in the past year, has there been a time when you felt you couldn't afford healthcare or you had to delay it, about 20% of Minnesotans said, yes, that happened. And typically we ask sort of about dental care, prescription drug, routine medical care, specialist care, but also mental health services. So about 20% of the population have that experience. Individuals without health insurance, of course, feel it much more imminently, but even people with what they consider decent coverage report that kind of experience. And I'll pause here maybe for a second if there are questions before I move on to wrap up my presentation.
Well, thank you. I do have some questions here. We've got Representative Bierman. I wasn't sure if you had a question before, and then I've got Baker and Moran.
Thank you. I did have another question right at the beginning of your second session. Thank you, Madam Chair. This was on page slide 10. After 2014, what was the reason for the precipitous drop there in the graph after the Affordable Care Act in 2014, where expenses or prices rose only by 1.9% by 2016? Can you explain what caused that?
Mr. Gildemeister.
Madam Chair, Representative Bierman, I don't know that we're certain about that. And primarily because this data is sort of brought together from 20 fairly high-level data sources, so this is not based on very granular data. What I would say, though, what is likely, there are two likely factors playing a role here. One is that people who came into the health insurance market in 2014 may have taken care of healthcare needs that had been untreated for a longer period of time, sort of creating what is called a pent-up demand. But seriously, the primary reason here has been prescription drugs in 2014. And I won't make that a test, but there was an article today in the Star Tribune on the drugs to treat hepatitis C, very costly drug. And Medicaid and the private sector all experienced the cost of that miracle drug, seriously, healing hepatitis C, and sort of struggle to make benefit decisions that was a major driver in every healthcare budget for that year. It then declined when there was more competition. I think Sovaldi was the first drug, then the second and the third drug entered the market that sort of dropped the price, still a very high price, but that is one major factor in the high cost for 2014.
Representative Bierman.
Thank you for that. And then I just wanted to clarify on the last portion where you talked about the pharmaceutical costs. Did you say the combined cost of pharmaceuticals in that pie chart was 20% for pharmacy out of the hospital plus hospitals?
Mr. Gildemeister.
Madam Chair, Representative Bierman, that's about right. And I'll give you an uncharacteristically precise answer. I always try to be precise because when we look at data, even more granular data, there is a whole host of billing where you know a drug was delivered, but you don't know the price, you don't know which drug it was, you don't know which dose it was. So there's a little bit of a gray area to our understanding. So if a surgery was delivered, you know anesthesia was delivered. You know what the cost for the whole surgery was, but you can't break it out because it was delivered as a bundle. So that creates a huge gray area around that, but it's close to 20%.
I have this.
And a Bierman.
Thank you. I have the same problem trying to figure out the bills I get from the hospital. You don't know what you're paying, really, for what services. So it's very unclear. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just following up on Representative Bierman, I think he was on the same path I was. 20% are those pharmaceutical costs. You were mentioning retail, following kind of the retail flow. Does that also include a lot of the drugs that are sent legally in medications in the mail?
Mr. Gildemeister.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes. So the retail calculation here would include mail order pharmacy.
So Madam Chair, follow up.
Baker.
And I've been to a lot of seminars with healthcare, addiction, opioids, and everybody seems to argue about the biggest cost of our healthcare is pharmaceuticals, and I think sometimes it's argued with the hospitals or whatever. In your opinion, then, you're seeing the largest care is pharmaceutical costs. Is that clear to you as well?
Mr. Gildemeister.
Madam Chair, Representative Baker, I wouldn't put it quite that way. Institutional care is very expensive. So care in just because it has a large component of labor to it and there's a lot of regulation wrapped up into our healthcare institution need to function. So hospital care and long-term care accounts for a large part of healthcare spending. So if you add that together, long-term and inpatient care, that's more than prescription drug spending. But I think what gives folks like me, well, and anyone who pays for healthcare great concern is sort of the trajectory on prescription drug spending that we're on. And if I can expound on that for a second, I would say not only do we see new brand name drugs coming to the market with a high level of price, but also we see prescription drugs that have been cheap generics and have been on the market for a long time experience ongoing and substantial price increases. So they might be lower, but they might be serving a really large population, and they're experiencing price increases over hundreds of dollars. So that trajectory worries me, and what really should give us concern is the next type of hepatitis C drug. What I mean by that is the next drug that is a miracle drug and that we want to have because it treats Alzheimer's disease or increases our lifespan if we have cancer, that will have an incredible pricing power. And we as society have to figure out how to sort of find that balance between supporting innovation but also being able to afford the drug equally across the board when it comes to the market.
Okay. Representative Morant.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking at slide 16 and healthcare spending, and you talked about that the cost of health care spending will double by 2026. But you also use a phrase about spending stupidly and saying that we're going to continue to do that, kind of like. But looking at the way we spend dollars here in the United States and how we spend and how healthcare spending is done around the country, you know, we can, you know, how would you characterize that? Would you say that other countries are spending smarter? They're doing it in a way that is more upfront. You know, I was just talking to a friend of mine who went to the doctor because he was having all this pain in his legs and his hip. And my thought was maybe he needed some hip replacement or a knee replacement or something like that. But at the end of the day, it seemed like he has a disc in his back where through years it has moved, and that's causing the pain. And they recommended that he can come in and get shots for the rest of his life, right? And this is like masking the pain. It's not treating anything. And often we just mask something. We don't go to find the root cause of whatever that may be. And thus, we just continue to just spend money on a problem that's not really going to the base of the problems. So are you seeing in other countries that they're doing something differently than what we're doing? Can you talk a little bit about that,
Mr. Gildemeister?
Representative Liebling.
Moran.
I'm sorry, Representative. Madam Moran. Chair, Representative Moran. I lost my slides, so I'm confused. Your question was so big that the slides went away. It's a really big question and a really tough one. At the same time, it's a fair one. I wouldn't characterize it as a difference between smart and stupid. I would say the systems differ in some really specific ways, and that creates different incentives and different practices. So I'll add some to that. Prices definitely are different between the healthcare in the U.S. and healthcare in other developed countries. And that's sort of a choice and a willingness to pay different prices. I think, you know, Commissioner Malcolm came before you last week, and she sort of pointed out to the fact that in this country we have relatively little social service spending, and that prevents us from intervening early on and upstream before chronic disease develops. And I think that's a really important point. We practice care differently in this country than in Europe. I think the opioid crisis we experience just doesn't exist in Germany, for instance, because there are different cultural approaches to pain, but there are also different rules and willingness to make rules around how to deliver some of these drugs and to what extent the industry can play a role in delivering services. And then this system in the U.S. is administratively very heavy, as many of you have noticed yourself, both on the provider side and on the health plan side. And that the cost of billing, the cost of managing multiple benefit, that shows up in healthcare spending. So I leave it to you to judge whether that is stupid or not, or not as smart as it should be. But I do have a slide later on, if we can pull it up, that sort of points at some of the areas where our healthcare system is characterized by waste and inefficiencies and something that we can work from if we wanted to.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Gildemeister. And did you have a follow-up, Representative Moran? And then I'm going to have two more people on the list, Haley Loeffler, and then we'll let Mr. Gildemeister finish his presentation. Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I also had the privilege to go to Taiwan, where they have universal health care, and the opioid crisis there is non-existing, too, because of how they do their health care system. But the other, you know, the other piece to this is that in Health and Human Service Policy, where I chair that committee, the one of the things that I opened up and said to the members of that committee that I want us to kind of like reimagine what our healthcare system needs to look like and how we can be more creative instead of, like, reforming, because when you reform, you start from the base of where you are, and we try to change those, you know. And it may be the base that we need to look at changing. And so I put that to you, you know, because I think you bring an expertise, overall expertise into this body that can be helpful to us. You know, I know you don't want to tell us what to do, but I think your expertise can help us better be smart about how we spend, because if we continue down this path and see ourselves in 2026 paying 94.2, is that million on health care? That's what it says. Yeah. You know, that can, you know, that could be a problem. Plus, we have a state of individuals who are not getting any more, they're not well. We're just treating the problems. That's it. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Moran. I don't know if that required an answer.
No,
I think we can go to, okay. So we've got Haley Loeffler Hamilton. And then if we can try to keep those brief, then we'll let Mr. Gildemeister finish his presentation. Representative Haley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering, Mr. Gildemeister, do you have any information on our across the regions in our state when we see averages often on the individual market, but I'm looking for what's the spread, the high and the low. My district in particular is southeastern Minnesota, and we pay the highest cost in the state. So when things are in the press or even in this body, the average means nothing when I have constituents that are still paying $30,000 a year. So that's something, if you don't, you could follow up with me if you would on that spread. And then I also wanted to ask you about what's happened at this change in the individual market. People in my district may have be buying their insurance, but they're not using it because the cost is so high. So their feeling is they are subsidizing the public programs, and that those folks are now getting insurance, which is a good thing, and getting health care, but they're paying, and yet they're not using it. Again, when you have a $30,000 deductible, I have a lot of farmers in my district, small business owners. They don't go to the doctor because they can't afford it. So the system is so out of balance, and I wondered if you had any input on that, and input on this change in utilization. So on the public program side, how are people using it? Is it emergency room spending? Is it, you know, primary care, which, you know, we want people to have child well checks and so forth? I think that data could be helpful to us as we try to look at, again, changing this system, and maybe there's behavior patterns that we need to change in order to kind of right size and equalize not only the cost of care, but also just the ability to access it, if that makes any sense.
Mr. Gildemeister?
Madam Chair, Representative Haley, again, a good question. I'm surprised my slides are staying up. But in response, I would say the question of the difference in spending in the individual market is sort of an empirical one. It can be analyzed. That data exists. My agency might not really have it, or it might not be identifiable that way, but that's something that is very, very doable. And then we can look at the factors, the cost of providers, the level of utilization, the mix of services, the way I've showed it here, that contributed in various ways to the difference in healthcare spending. So it's, yes, that's an answerable question, but it might take time and might take energy. The question around the individual market and the cost of care, I don't know that I might have to think about this a little bit to give you a coherent answer. But what I would say is it's not my sense that the cost of the individual market is an outcome of providing coverage through public programs. And mostly because these are really separate risk pools and plans are required to sort of generate premiums that they think are actually valid for the population who they're expecting to see in the individual market. If they're wrong, then they will make a large profit well, if they're wrong one way, they will make a large profit, potentially spending less on MLR, and will have to give resources back. If they're right, if they're wrong in the other way, they might lose money, as they have in 14, 15, and 16, I think. I think the long story short is that healthcare spending in the individual market is high, in part because it's a very small market. It's a very small risk pool, and if one were interested in creating a really effective market, it would require bringing healthy risk into the market and bringing more people into the market, not just young individuals, but healthy individuals. Otherwise, you have sort of a pseudo higher risk pool, which means people buy individual market coverage because they feel they might need it. They might not use it, but they, the ones who feel they might need it, buy that coverage. So you get a market with increasing prices. You know, I don't want to use the term premium spiral, though I have just now, but I mean, that's the potential fear that, you know, as prices get more expensive and the value declines, the people at the healthier part step away from the market, making the market more expensive. So that's something maybe we can again have Peter Brickwitty answer for you in a more coherent way than I was able to.
Yeah, and members, we're kind of you know, we have only until quarter after, and so we're going to ask Mr. Brickwitty, with apologies, to hold off on his presentation so that Mr. Gildemeister can finish. And I know there's a lot of member interest. I have a couple, three more members on the list that I really want Mr. Gildemeister to be able to finish his presentation. I just want to respond a bit to Representative Haley's question, too, because I think I understood in there kind of a question about whether people are paying high prices in the individual market sort of because there's something going on in the public and that there's some sort of cross shift there. And that's probably a pretty complicated question, but I just want you to recall that in our public programs, a lot of the spending, I think it was 80% of Medicaid, is going through capitated payments to health plans. And so if somebody on Medicaid goes to the emergency room once or 10 times, or they go to the doctor or they don't go to the doctor, in terms of the state spending, that capitated amount is the same. So just to kind of remind you of that. And so I think it is kind of it's a complicated issue, you know, where the cross-subsidy and all that is with the hospitals and all that, but I just kind of wanted to point that out. We have Representative Loeffler, and then I'm going to go Loeffler and Hamilton. I know Munson also has a question, but after Hamilton, we're going to let Mr. Gildemeister finish quickly before we take more questions. So Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Gildemeister. Slide 19. Shows a dramatic increase after 2015, which is relatively recent history in our experience here. And it looks to me that there was about a 75% increase in enrollee cost per program, but only 35 to 40% of that could be explained by medical costs going up in the same, just kind of guessing from the scales on your graph. That's a dramatic gap of 35% or so in just a couple of years. And I'm wondering if you can get us some information about what is that? Is that profit and transfer to reserves? Is that reduced employer coverage? Not everyone in this market would even have an employer contribution. Or was it just a matter of taking what you could get out of the market? I mean, but the fact that it didn't in any way parallel the increase in medical care costs is a concern with such a high degree of increase just in the last 2 years of data.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That wasn't really a question.
Well, but I'm just wondering if he can give us some clarification, and yes, he may need to go back to his research, but
right,
that was when we put, yep, hundreds of millions of dollars of state dollars in a variety of, right, of approaches to try and stabilize the market. And obviously, we weren't successful.
Right. Mr. Gildemeister?
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, I think you're right in interpreting the graph, and I think the chair's right, too, in saying we'll have to think about how to pull together information to help shed some light on it. Again, it'll be difficult to ascribe causality to it, but I think we can certainly look at some of the variables that you mentioned and ask sort of what has been transpiring.
That'd be very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Gildemeister, if you already covered this, my apologies, just say so and I'll catch up on my own time. But you mentioned that both generics and brand name drugs are going up at an alarming rate in price. I want to know why.
Another small question. Mr. Gildemeister.
Madam Chair, Representative Hamilton, I would argue there are probably multiple reasons for that, and this is not intended to be a cop-out. I'll try to get into it a little bit. And I should also say that I'm not a pharmacoeconomist, so my understanding of it is somewhat limited. But we've been working with some experts at the university to help us sharpen our understanding. Multiple reasons. Prices go up because they can. And what that means is somebody might have a monopoly. They might have figured out to extend the patent of the life of a patent by sort of reformulating the product without actually changing it or introducing a new product. They might be controlling the pipeline, buying up the industry that produces the ingredients. It's just a lot of clever ways of doing that. I think some people call it greed. I think it's very, in some ways, it's very American, and it is taking advantage of the system, the patent system that we've built. Sometimes greed is very obviously part of that, but nevertheless, typically it is within the guardrails of the law. There are some, the Attorney General in Minnesota, the previous Attorney General in Minnesota, and others are suing some generic manufacturers for price fixing. That's not legal, but that might also be a reason and driving some of it. But also, to go back to my example of the hepatitis C drug, the way the industry responded to the outcry over the cost of that drug, about $900,000 for a treatment of one person, was that they said, look, hepatitis C is an expensive expensive disease. It can damage the kidney, it can damage other body parts. Treatment is very expensive. We calculate the lifetime expenses for treating that person, and that's what we're pricing the drug at. Mm. So again, nothing particularly illegal about it, but those are some of the reasons.
Representative Hamp.
And just a comment, Madam Chair. All five of those examples that you gave, these are my words, not yours. I personally think it's legalized theft, and we can do something about it.
And thank you, Representative Hamilton. I certainly hope that we will. I'm all with you on that. Thank you. Mr. Gildemeister, do you want to try to quick close up, and then hopefully we'll get to a couple more questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair, for sure. I feel a little bad that I left you with a lot of gloomy information here. Coverage is dropping. Spending is rising. Markets are failing to discipline prices. And I haven't even shown you this chart, which shows that healthcare spending rises faster than any other indicator. Well, many economic indicators in the economy, per capita income, average weekly wages, GSP, or inflation. But I think I want to leave you with a number of positive notions, not so you feel better, but because I think there's actually some optimism to be had. Yes, healthcare spending is expensive, but healthcare spending is also concentrated or a large share of healthcare spending is concentrated among a small portion of the population. So this chart is best read from the right, because we line up everyone's healthcare spending from lowest to highest. So if we start from the right and look at the highest, at the individuals with the highest 5% of spending, they account for about 54, almost 55% actually of total spending. If we can figure out ways not just to deliver the care for people with these high healthcare needs better in a more coordinated fashion and aligned with the patient's preferences, I think we can generate savings and efficiencies. But more importantly, and again going back to what you heard from Commissioner Malcolm, if we think about how to invest upstream to prevent a disease or prevent progression of a disease in the first place, we might also be able to change the picture and change the level of growth. This is more about the level of spending, although I think it also has a component of growth. Representative Moran sort of mentioned the question about, you know, are we spending stupidly or not? Again, I'm not sure that I would say we're spending stupidly because we have a lot of smart stakeholders in the system operating smartly. But we know that there is a considerable amount of waste built into the healthcare system. So that at a national level, we think it's about a third of healthcare spending going to unnecessary administrative complexity. To Representative Greenhagen's point, you know, accounting for over-treatment, sort of low-value services, or under-treatment, people not having the kind of access to service that they might need, for example, dental services or mental health services, but also designing a healthcare market where information is really opaque and prices can't really do the job that we think they should be doing in markets and that they do in markets elsewhere. So again, we have a lot of information on where this waste and inefficiency is, and that gives an opportunity to sort of rethink how we want the system to operate. And then, again, this is also something Commissioner Malcolm mentioned. There are incredible disparities in healthcare access and healthcare services in Minnesota. This example, we're just looking at adolescent mental health screening and depression screening, and you know, it shows really different rates of screening across the state. It may be a function of the culture of mental illness. It may be a function of access to mental health services. Children and adolescents providers are really sparse in rural areas. You know, that might relate to these numbers, but having the data collected, knowing these differences, understanding that mental illness is a disease and it needs to be integrated in the delivery of healthcare offers opportunities not just to change this picture but also to limit the exacerbating effects of mental illness for people with chronic disease. So we know a lot. We have a lot of opportunities. You have a lot of opportunities to affect some of these trends. It'll be difficult. There are a lot of stakeholders in the system who might lose in the process, but as part of the report that we're preparing to finalize for submission to the legislature, we've seen a bunch of really good models evolve across the country that one could think about and learn from if the goal is to affect the underlying trends that I've spoken of today. Thank you so much. And I'm sorry I took so much time.
No, Mr. Gildermeister, that's great. Representative Munson had a question, and then we'll wrap up here.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I had a question in response to Representative Haley's comments about the private insurance, the concerns of private insurance people thinking they're subsidizing the public insurance programs. And I understand that they're in two different buckets, two different risk pools. But there's a large hospital organization in Minnesota that really schedules patients based on whether they have, you know, medical assistance or private insurance, and the mere fact that they are using those two buckets in order to schedule patients and really rationing care for medical assistance versus private insurance people who can get in to see doctors faster, doesn't that also show that they are in a way subsidizing care for medical assistance? Or do you see that correlation in your data,
Mr. Gildermeister?
Madam Chair, Representative Munson. You know, a couple of thoughts. So I think it's fair to say that delivering healthcare in the individual market does not appear in isolation. So sometimes I think the provider might not even know what insurance coverage the patient has because that happened in the front office. I think we sort of have our prejudices and maybe our understanding of how the world works, and we know who's coming through the door nevertheless, and that might affect how we treat and deliver care. So I think it's naive to say different payers and different patients don't get different experiences, and I think sometimes we sort of hear this through the slip of a tongue. From what I know from academic research over, I would say, 20 or so years, the issue that seems so intuitive that, of course, if the public requires lower prices, then the private sector must be sponsoring them. It is intuitive, I will admit it, but it's not been bearing out in research, and I'm happy to share that with you. Maybe that will change over time. Maybe it has already. The studies are maybe 5 or so years old that I've seen. So far, that sort of subsidization does not exist, which seems to argue hospital systems, which are no longer hospital, but are billion-dollar industries delivering complex healthcare decisions and making complex investment decisions as well, have the flexibility to adjust in other ways. I know it's an unsatisfying response, but maybe it'll be helpful if I share some of the evidence that I'm referring to.
Thank you, Mr. Gildemeister. That would be excellent. Members, we're just a couple minutes over time. Thank you very much, Mr. Gildemeister. This was tremendous. At our next meeting, we're going to have to reschedule Mr. Brickwitty, but also we're going to hear from DHS and the counties, and this is in response to a question from Representative Grunhagen about scenarios of people who are on public programs. So thank you. We are adjourned.